This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Moonlight is fiction, but it draws on the lives of its writers, who are my first guests. It's the story of a quiet, introverted African-American boy, Chiron, growing up in a housing project in Miami's Liberty City. He's constantly bullied. As his mother becomes addicted to crack, she becomes less present in his life. The movie is told in three chapters, each focusing on Chiron at a different age, as a child, a high school student, and young man. As time goes by, he grows more aware of and confused by his sexuality. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott wrote this after seeing Moonlight's premiere at the Telluride Film Festival. To say that it received a warm welcome would be a drastic understatement. There were tears and standing ovations. My guest Barry Jenkins wrote and directed Moonlight. He also wrote and directed the film Medicine for Melancholy. He adapted Moonlight from a play by Terrell McCraney, who's also with us. McCraney was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship in 2013, which is more commonly known as the Genius Award. He's been an ensemble member of Steppenwolf Theater and international writer-in-residence at the Royal Shakespeare Company. McCraney and Jenkins grew up in the same housing project where the movie Moonlight is set. Let's start with a scene from the first chapter of Moonlight. The young Chiron is at the home of a drug dealer and the dealer's girlfriend, Teresa, who've been giving Chiron the guidance and comfort he hasn't been getting at home. Bullies have taunted Chiron with a derogatory word, but Chiron doesn't know what that word means.
What's a faggot?
A faggot is a word used to make gay people feel bad.
Am I a faggot?
No. You could be gay, but you ain't gotta let nobody call you no faggot. I mean, unless...
How do I know?
You just do. I think.
You know what you know.
Hey, you gotta know right now. Not yet.
Do you sell drugs?
Yeah.
And my mom. She do drugs, right?
Barry Jenkins, Terrell McCraney, welcome to Fresh Air. I love the film. Congratulations on it. So the explanation that the drug dealer gives to Chiron about what the word faggot means is it's a word to use to make gay people feel bad about themselves. That's really a great definition to give a kid. Which of you wrote that line?
I can't even remember.
Okay.
Right. I mean, there are things in the script that because we're doing so many Q&As that I'm like, did I write that? Did Terrell write that? it kind of just blends into this thing.
I think the sentiment is certainly both of ours, if I may be so bold. I know Barry constructed the scene for sure. I think in the original, he asks about it, and the drug dealer says something like, you know, you don't have to know right now, which actually happened to me. That's an actual conversation I had with a drug dealer in my neighborhood. He kind of said, you know, you don't have to know everything right now about who you are, which was a sort of a nugget that I kind of carried with me. Because there are moments where I'm like, well, shouldn't I know everything about myself? Shouldn't I be fully formed in my identity, who I am, what I am, what I want? And I kind of always go back to that place of you don't really have to know right now. You know, we don't always need to know exactly at this moment. So,
well, Terrell, in the movie, it's the drug dealer who becomes like a father surrogate for this boy and is really the only person who's willing to kind of take care of him, provide for him, reassure him. Did the drug dealer who you referred to play that role in your life?
Yes, for lack of a better, more nuanced answer, yes, I think yes, he did. I think what Barry did was exactly what I was trying to do in the original work, which was try to show the magnitude of this very short period of time. I mean, they meet when this kid is already cognitive and conscious of the world and already kind of undergoing some bullying and stresses and pressures. And then what we don't see and what actually happened in life is that that time was pretty short. I met the drug dealer who was in my life was a man named Blue, who was dating my mother at the time and sort of came into my life when I was 5 or 6 years old and was a very affectionate to me, very kind to me, very generous to me in a way that I hadn't quite experienced with many male figures, including my own father at the time. And I just remember him never, I remember at some point thinking he treats me like I'm his son, regardless of the fact that I don't share any of his blood. And I did know that he was a drug dealer. And I did know that my mom did drugs. So, I mean, those, you know, those conversations were had, but not as, you know, eloquently as sort of Barry made them happen, which I think is sort of beautiful. And then one day I came home from school and came home for a weekend. And I actually think it was my birthday weekend. I had gone away to my biological father's aunt's house and I came home and my mom said, you know, Blue's dead. And he's not coming back anymore.
What happened?
He had been shot and killed over the weekend. He had gotten shot and killed by, we assume, rival drug members in the neighborhood or drug dealers in the neighborhood who then later came in and moved into that neighborhood. Yeah, so, and I just remember having this kind of feeling of, what's the word? I remember feeling like I need to start counting now. I need to pay attention now because when I go away, things will go away. When I stop looking, when I stop paying attention, the things that I care about, the things that are good to me, will disappear.
Barry, I want to bring you in the conversation in a minute, but I just have a couple of more questions for Terrell.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
Okay, so the main character...
Of course you are.
the main character, the boy in this, who we see grow into manhood, is bullied and he's called a faggot before he understands what the word means and before he really understands whether he's gay or not. So, Terrell, does that come from your experience of like feeling like maybe you're gay before you comprehended what that meant or before knowing if you really were, but other people were saying that you were before you knew?
I mean, it took me a long time to figure out what gay meant to me. I mean, even to this day, I have to qualify people because they think gay means or gay to them in their sort of heteronormative thinking of it means that I only engage in sexual acts with men. And to me, gay means being in an intimate, loving relationship with a person of the same gender to me. And I feel like that it took me a long time to come to that because I didn't really actually understand that. And I couldn't understand why people were calling me gay. I certainly had an attraction to women, still have an attraction to women. But what they did see me do or they could see in me is that I was more graceful than the other boys. I was less rough and tumble. I wanted to go to ballet class. I liked spinning around in circles. I crossed my legs when I sat down. I didn't walk like I, you know, had just gotten off of a horse. Those things were things that they, you know, they sort of saw in me instantly and they sort of said, this phenotypic view of you must be what you're feeling inside. And that couldn't be further than the truth. At the time, again, I was into He-Man and She-Ra equally, if that makes any sense.
Well, in the movie, Chiron runs and cowers when he's bullied and ganged up on by kids who are, you know, accusing him of being gay. What was your reaction? Were you bullied? And did you run? Did you fight back?
I did all of the above. All of the above. I mean, sometimes you fight. Sometimes you know that this is not the day to fight. Sometimes you know, sometimes you tell an adult. I mean, what I quickly learned is that telling adults did little to nothing.
Who did you tell? You know,
teachers, my parents, police officers. There was one time these kids had pretty much beat me up pretty bad. And I was on the corner. And I sort of limped my way home. And then the police came about 6 hours later to ask me about it. And they said, yeah, well, kids will be kids. And I said, okay. So, and I knew then that there were a few ways to sort of deal with this, and telling adults was not that way.
So, Barry Jenkins, you directed and wrote the screenplay for Moonlight. What did you relate to about the story that made you want to adapt it into a film?
You know, I saw myself in this character, Chiron, both in the way that he felt sort of isolated from the world around him, the way Terrell just did this great job of creating a character who, over the course of the years, kind of retreats, you know, retracts within himself to escape the world around him. And then also, you know, Terrell and I grew up blocks away from one another, and we went to, I believe, the same elementary school at the same time, and both our moms succumbed to this ordeal with crack cocaine. And I had never talked about that in my work. I'd really never talked about it with even some of my closest friends. And so when I read the piece, you know, I thought this will be a great way to kind of hide behind Terrell, but deal with some of these very personal things. You know, I was like, oh, this is Terrell's story. This is great. I'm just going to tuck a few things in. And it'll be all about Terrell, and I'm just the guy pressing the button, you know. But of course, you know, when you get into something, you know, this heavy, this deep, there's no way you can sort of manage or compartmentalize how much of yourself you give to it. And so what ended up happening was I kind of became this character in a certain way, which was great, because I think the only way to do the film, to complete it in the way that we did, and to give myself to these actors in the way I had to, was to just fully allow myself to live in the piece.
So just, you know, regarding the question of homosexuality and masculinity, you know, like proving your masculinity, you probably had no problem, you know, like proving your masculinity to the other kids in the housing project where you grew up, because you were on the high school football team. You were a running back.
Yeah, I did not. You know, I wasn't known as a neighborhood tough or anything like that. But yeah, I was like a scrappy kid. You know, I kind of kept to myself. You know, there's Terrell and I have had this conversation recently, actually. There are elements of the character Chiron, his personality, that I think are much more like me than they are like Terrell as far as the middle school years go. You know, Terrell very quickly realized that he wanted to be an artist, you know, and he was involved in the theater. He was very expressive, whereas I was not. I really sort of kept to myself. I kind of just watched the world. And I think to keep people from messing with me, yeah, you know, I went out to run track. I went out for the football team. Not because I love track or love football, you know, I just thought, you know, I can do this. And if I do this, this is one less thing for anyone to sort of like poke at, you know. And I kind of excelled at those things. And it became not a performance in a certain way, because there, you know, like Terrell, I didn't have many father figures. And what ended up happening was these coaches became the father figures in my life. And it's why there were certain things in the play that, again, you know, I never had a blue in my life, but I remember, you know, a coach teaching me how to hurdle, you know, how to jump over these hurdles, which was actually a very complicated, complex thing. And you don't believe you can get over the hurdle until you sort of get past this block. And when I read the swimming scene in the play, I was like, oh, I know exactly what that is. So there were just all these things that were spread throughout the piece that I could put myself into.
So you didn't know each other growing up in the same housing project, but one of the things you have in common is growing up with mothers who were addicted to drugs, to crack?
Yes.
Yes.
So, you know, in the movie Moonlight, the boy's mother is addicted to crack. We see her grow increasingly dependent on it, and we see her life increasingly go to pieces as a result of it. How old were you when you realized that your mothers were addicted?
I believe I was 7 when my mom had her first overdose. I remember I was on my way to school and I couldn't tie my shoe correctly, so it must have been like first grade or second grade, so 7, 8. But my aunt came and said, you know, you have to go to school. And I said, well, my mom's sick. And they said, that's okay. I remember there were paramedics there. I didn't know what I would do after school. I remember having, you know, I was one of those kids who always had a very strange reaction to things. I was like, I think she'll be okay. I hope she's okay. I also don't, I don't want to make her mad by not going to the right place after school. I want to be in the place that she needs me to be after school. So I had to be around seven when I realized that, you know, this, what she was going through was caused by drugs.
Yeah. And I was much younger. I was 3 or 4, I want to say. And I remember it as just these snippets of imagery of just things going on around this very small apartment, that I could see, but could not see. Which I think was an inspiration for the hallway with the pink light and moonlight. You know, my mom was, you know, a very hardworking, working class, single mom. She raised, I have a brother and a sister who are 9 and 10 years older than me. And so for them, I think it was a much more jarring process because, you know, they knew this very, very strong sort of woman. And then very rapidly, I remember over the course of weeks, everything kind of just got torn apart, and it literally felt like she just disappeared. You know, everything just changed overnight.
I want to play a scene from Moonlight in which Chiron's mother is addicted to crack, and she's having a lot of trouble finding enough money to keep her supplied. And in this scene, she doesn't have enough money. She's drug sick. And that she knows that her son, through the drug dealer's girlfriend, that the girlfriend sometimes gives him money to help him out. So she wants him to hand over some of that money from Teresa. So here's the scene with Chiron, played as a teenager by Ashton Sanders, and the mother, Paula, played by Naomi Harris.
I need some money.
For what?
That's my business. Don't you ask me no like that.
Well, I don't have no money.
No, don't lie to me, boy. I'm your mama. That over there ain't no kin of you. I'm your blood, remember? I ain't feeling good. I need something to help me out. Come on, baby. Come on, baby.
Where am I supposed to get money from?
Why? Teresa ain't give you nothing, huh? You little play, mama, ain't put something in your head. Give me that damn money, Chiron. Give me the damn money!
I don't have no money. Mama, come on.
Give me the damn money,
Chiron. Mama, come on, give all me right, the all damn right, money. All right. Here, man.
Yes, that is what I thought. You my child, okay? And tell that you better not forget it. Go on to school. Ain't you late?
That's a scene from Moonlight. The story is by Terrell McCraney. Barry Jenkins wrote the screenplay and directed the film Moonlight. So we were talking about how you each grew up with crack-addicted mothers. Did money become an issue like this in your home?
Most certainly. Most certainly for me. I think we, there were times, you know, that we were without food and the lights got turned off often. And I remember pretty much throughout my entire middle school life, we didn't have a phone. And so my teachers would often ask how to get in contact with my mother if something was going wrong at school. And they would just sort of think, okay, well, I have to send a note or I have to call the neighbor's phone. We often use my neighbor's phone, which actually for me is the inspiration for Teresa. We had these really awesome neighbors to our left and right in our apartment complex who just were extremely generous. They had kids of their own, but somehow they were trying to take care of these 4 kids that they knew were in a bad place. So if I did get money from an aunt or a grandmother or whoever, more often than not, you know, my mom would find a way to take it or talk me out of it, or sometimes the TV would disappear or sometimes the furniture would disappear. So.
Barry, what about you?
No, my mom was just completely absent for those years. You know, I like to say the character Paula is a blend or a composite of my life and Terrell's life, or my mom and Terrell's mom. And I think these years, the teenage years in the film and in the play, rest exclusively with Terrell. I'm sorry, I'm having a moment because I just remember directing that scene, and it's funny to hear it. I can hear the birds chirping in the background, and it's a bit jarring. I'm very cool, calm, and collected on set, but this was really, really difficult to do, and so to hear it out of context or in context and hear those birds.
When you say it was difficult, do you mean emotionally difficult, or was just like a difficult scene to shoot?
Emotionally. It wasn't difficult to shoot at all. Naomi showed up extremely prepared. That actually was the first scene in the film that she shot. And she did all her work in 3 days. So when I say it was difficult, it was, you know, I was very jarringly thrown back into this time with my mother, reliving some things that actually happened and some things that clearly happened to Terrell. And it was just the most difficult thing I think I've ever had to do in my life, because I've gone a long time without thinking of my mother as that person, you know, because I do think that's a whole other person from the mother I know now. And I think because of that, I hadn't really dealt with what that time was like, you know, or with what she went through, and seeing Naomi fully embody these very dark things that I know she went through. It just opened up this portal where I saw so many other things that aren't in the film that I know my mom went through. And it was just really difficult to be professional and do those things, because my job, you know, on set as a director is to live those moments with the actors. But it's different when the actor is living a moment that's taken from someone you love's life.
So it made you think about what your mother had gone through?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And not even think about it. I mean, I could see it, you know. Mm-hmm. I could feel it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, I hope this isn't too much to ask, but I love the way you interact with each other, so I'm hoping that you stay friends and that you get to collaborate with each other on something else. Is that too much?
Very
is that
much
too
so.
Much to
I,
ask?
No, I love Terrell, and I'll say this on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You know, the beauty of working with Terrell and knowing Terrell is he has provided the space for me to come out of retirement as a filmmaker, but also to come out of my shell and actually be open and honest about some of these things that we've talked about our moms and about growing up and just feeling not whole. So I thank you, my brother, for helping me feel whole. We will definitely remain friends.
Good.
For sure. We have no choice.
Good. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you, and congratulations on Moonlight. It's a wonderful film. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tarek.
Barry Jenkins wrote and directed the new film Moonlight. It's adapted from a play by Terrell McCraney. Over Mary Oliver's long career, she's received many honors for her poetry, including the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Oliver has also published numerous collections of essays, ranging from subjects like her decades of living by the ocean in Provincetown, her most beloved writers, as well as her dogs. Oliver's latest collection is called Upstream, and book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I need a moment away from the unceasing word drip of debates about the election, about whether Elena Ferrante has the right to privacy, about whether Bob Dylan writes literature. I need a moment, more than a moment, in the steady and profound company of Mary Oliver, and I think you might need one too. Mary Oliver's latest book is a collection of essays called Upstream. Most of these pieces have been published elsewhere, but reshuffled here, they form a kind of sporadic spiritual autobiography. If that label sounds precious, you don't know you're Mary Oliver. As much as she's a visionary poet, she's also the quintessential tough old broad who finds traces of awe in, for example, scooping out the shining wet pink bladder of a codfish, or getting down on all fours with her dog out in the woods, and for an hour or so, seeing the world from the level of the grasses. These essays are the product of a lifetime that Oliver has spent closely reading nature, as well as the work of other writers. The rewards of paying attention, says Oliver, became clear to her early on. In an opening essay called Staying Alive, about escaping from her difficult childhood into nature and literature, Oliver recalls, "This is what I learned. that the world's otherness is antidote to confusion, that standing within this otherness, the beauty and the mystery of the world, out in the fields or deep inside books, can redignify the worst-stung heart. There's hardly a page in my copy of Upstream that isn't folded down or underlined and scribbled on, so charged is Oliver's language. What her language is not is sentimental or confessional. As a teenager coming of age in Ohio in the 1950s, Oliver says she felt painfully different. Certainly one could assume her sexuality and literary ambitions set her apart. But rather than supplying biographical details, Oliver conveys the raw essence of her isolation in an essay entitled, My Friend, Walt Whitman. Oliver calls Whitman the brother I did not have. In her youth, Oliver says, I lived many hours within the lit circle of Whitman's certainty and his bravado. Oliver's affinity with Whitman and other outdoorsy types like Wordsworth and Emerson makes sense, but her empathy for claustrophobic tale of terror master Edgar Allan Poe is surprising, until you remember the emotional isolation she hints at in those essays about childhood. Her essay here on Poe turns out to be the most compassionate piece on him I've ever read. The second half of this collection takes Oliver through middle age and beyond. She's 81 now. A standout is the essay called Bird, where Oliver recalls finding an injured seagull on the winter beach in Provincetown, where she lived for many years. She carries it back to the house she shared with her late partner, the photographer Molly Malone Cook, and together they settle the gull on an island of towels near a glass door that overlooks the harbor. The gull's injured body, Oliver says, is a shattered elegance, one wing broken, the other hurt, both feet withered. Nevertheless, the gull is responsive, even playful. He looks forward every day to a dip in the bathtub and then sunning himself and having his feathers smoothed by visitors. Weeks pass, the gull loses an atrophied leg, a wing, still he hangs on. Oliver writes, but the rough and tumble work of dying was going on, even in the quiet body. When I picked him up, the muscles along the breast were so thin, I feared for the tender skin lying across the crest of the bone. And still, the eyes were full of the spices of amusement. He was, of course, a piece of the sky. His eyes said so. This is not fact. This is the other part of knowing something, when there is no proof, but neither is there any way toward disbelief. Attaining that other part of knowing something has been Oliver's life work. Her poems and essays are her own full-throated response to the question she poses at the very end of one of her best-known poems, The Summer Day. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Upstream by Mary Oliver. If you've ever been a victim of malware, been shamed on Twitter, or just worried about the unintended consequences of the internet, social media, and artificial intelligence, well, the British series Black Mirror is for you. It's a dystopian anthology series inspired by shows like The Twilight Zone, but it's set in the digital era. My guest, Charlie Brooker, created Black Mirror and is the primary writer. The series originated on the BBC. Season 3 is now streaming on Netflix. Brooker started his career in comedy and has done several shows on British TV satirizing the news and the media. Let's start with a scene from the new season of Black Mirror. In this episode, called Hated in the Nation, a detective played by Kelly MacDonald and an IT specialist are investigating some unusual deaths that seem linked to a hashtag on Twitter that's targeting people for execution.
So each tweet had a sort of instruction video attached to it.
Uh-huh.
There.
Game of consequences.
It's like an unpopularity contest. Pick someone you don't like, and if enough other people choose the same name, then that's who gets targeted. Here, watch.
Game of consequences. 1. Pick a target.
Oh my god.
2. Post their name and photo with hashtag #death2. 3. Most popular targets will be eliminated after 5 p.m. each day. 4. Game resets at midnight.
Someone's holding a public ballot bumping off the top person. Jesus, it's just mad.
Yeah, and it's growing.
Charlie Brooker, welcome to Fresh Air. So I imagine, I'm trying to imagine your writing process and you being in front of your screen writing and thinking, how can I take trolling and Twitter lynch mobs to its ultimate extreme? what was your process like of coming up with that premise?
Well, it's not a million miles away from that. I suppose, really, what I don't tend to do, actually, is kind of look at the news or look at technological developments and then try and think of a storyline based around those. Generally, what happens is often I'll be in conversation with somebody, often Annabelle Jones, who's the co-showrunner on the show, and I'm just thinking of what strikes me as a fairly delicious what if idea. And then if there's some technological means by which I can see that event happening, I'll sort of latch onto that, if that makes sense. So I kind of tend to work it round that way. So in a way, I tend to focus more initially on the sort of more popcorn, hooky sort of storytelling device rather than the real world sort of mirror, you know, the subject of the episode. Generally, I'm quite a paranoid and worried person.
So, I wouldn't have known that from the series.
I mean, I can worry about anything. You know, I could worry that I'm going to bleed to death, you know, from cutting my finger on a sandwich packet, you know, if I sort of open a sandwich. I could worry about pretty much anything you put in front of me. So I'm not actually sort of anti-technology. So it doesn't sort of come out of that. It's not like a fear of the future. It's a fear of everything, generally speaking.
Is that supposed to be reassuring? It's not technology.
Know.
It's everything that you're panicked about.
I think it's therapeutic. I think it's because, you see, in the UK, I'm probably better known as a comedy writer, or certainly that's my background, is in writing comedy. And I think it uses a similar muscle. Writing something like Black Mirror, where you're examining worst case scenarios, in a way isn't that different from thinking up sort of grotesque scenarios for comedy, you know, for sitcoms or sketches, really. And quite often when we're having the initial ideas and I'm sort of talking it through, I'm really laughing a lot. You know, it's not just written by some angry guy waving his fist at the App Store. You know, I'm generally laughing while I'm doing that.
So getting back to the premise of the episode Hated in the Nation. Mm-hmm. So the premise is that there's this new Twitter attack plan where there's like somebody who's singled out every day with mm-hmm. a #death2 hashtag, and then mm-hmm. they're going to be, you know, killed, basically.
In a grotesque way,
which we won't give away. Mm. So what's the most extreme sort of Twitter shaming or Twitter attack that you've been witness to, that you were thinking about when you were writing this?
Well, really, I mean, Black Mirror started in 2011, and I would say that probably around 2013, I was aware there was a general, I would say, a change in mood online. I think more and more people became aware that social media was starting to feel like a more toxic space. And, I mean, there were quite a lot of incidents of people getting very, very angry about all kinds of things and attacking people.
Have you ever been Twitter shamed or been the subject of a Twitter storm?
No, I haven't. Back in 2004, I wrote a column for the Guardian newspaper in Britain. I'm anxious. I'm loath to bring it up in a way, but I wrote a column where I ended it with a tasteless joke about George Bush, W. Bush. And it was a joke about sort of Lee Harvey Oswald, basically. It was a fairly clumsy joke. And it was an old joke as well, the one that I'd seen about Margaret Thatcher. But it kind of went viral, I guess you'd say, and the Guardian had to issue an apology, and I got lots of blood-curdling messages threatening me, and So it wasn't quite the same because this was pre-social media, really, or pre-Twitter. And it was interesting what that does to you psychologically was fascinating once I'd got through it.
What did it do to you psychologically?
There's a character in Hated in the Nation explains that it feels like a change in the weather. It feels like there's this iron cloud, ominous iron cloud hanging over you. And rather like a mental illness, it feels like there's invisible people who hate you, who are out there somewhere and are shouting at you.
One of your characters in one of the episodes says, there's no cure for the internet.
No, there isn't. And I don't want to sound... This might seem like a weird thing to say, but I really don't want to sound like overly negative or critical of the internet in general, because I'm actually really quite pro technology. I used to be a video games journalist. I love any new gadget or gizmo that comes along. I love all the details in the show. Any technological details, I try to get involved in as much as possible. I love all that sort of thing. Things like social media and the internet. Of course, it's not going away. There is no cure for it. And there shouldn't be, just like there shouldn't be, it would have been a tragedy if there was a cure for the printing press. I think it's just that it's an amazing tool that we as an animal are just getting to grips with, because it's like we've grown a new ultra powerful limb and we're learning how to use it. And so at the moment we're flailing around occasionally and knocking over the furniture, and we're having to deal, we're learning how to deal with these new capabilities that we have, these new superpowers we've suddenly been granted.
How would you how would you describe Black Mirror to someone who hasn't seen it?
I'd say run away. No, I would. The first thing I would say, I guess, is that they're all standalone stories. So it's an anthology in the old school sense, in that every single episode is a completely different story with a different cast and a different tone. And it's in my head, it's quite a fun house. In my head, it's sort of quite popcorn and quite a romp. But that doesn't necessarily translate to the way other people see it. It's quite a dark... if it's a box of chocolates full of variety, they're all dark chocolate. It's in the vein of shows like The Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, that kind of dark storytelling, hopefully with an ultra-black vein
ending.
Yeah, and some ultra-black humour. And it's not always a twist ending, actually. It's weird in that we sometimes we have a twist in the tale, not always. And it's interesting, I have to remind myself not to always, we don't always have to veer towards a twist, but there's something I find very satisfying about a nice ironic twist.
Last season, there was an episode about politics. And there was a CGI bear that's voiced by a very crude comic. And on a TV show, the bear, this CGI bear interviews a conservative candidate for parliament. And the bear taunts him. The audience loves it. So the producers decide that in order to boost ratings even more and to boost the value of this bear's brand, they're going to project the CGI bear on the side of a van and park it outside of this candidate's meet and greets and continue to taunt him. And then on a TV program panel discussion of candidates, the candidates include this CGI bear, and the audience is loving the bear because the bear has decided to run for office. So the politician, who's played by Tobias Menzies, is trying to convince the audience of this panel discussion to ignore this bear, this fake candidate, and focus on real issues. Here's a scene.
I think we have to ask ourselves, what is this for? And why do we waste our time with animated trivialities like him? I mean, why?
Why?
I mean, why? I mean, why? I mean, why? I mean, why?
This is just the kind of thing. Well, you see, you laugh.
They laugh at you, Limbo.
You laugh. But you are laughing at someone who won't engage, who is scared to engage, who hides behind a children's cartoon.
Who are you calling a kiddie tune, fool?
I'm speaking about James Salter.
Hmm? It's your name, isn't it? And James Salter. This is the man who's behind all this.
He's 33 years old, a man whose career can be summed up surprisingly quickly. You were in a sketch troupe who enjoyed sort of minor success about 6 years ago, and the others moved on to better things. But your main achievement seems to have been playing the part of a corn on the cob in a high-interest personal loan commercial. I notice you keep that pretty quiet. And now, of course, operating this sort of teddy bear thing, which, by the way, is easier than it looks. Anyone could do it. See, this is the thing. It's easy, what he does. Now, he mocks. And when he can't think of an authentic joke, which is actually quite often, he just swears. I think that this puppet's inclusion on this panel debases the process of debate and smothers any meaningful discussion of the issues. So I return to my original question. Is that really what this is for? He has nothing to offer, and he has nothing to say. Prove me wrong. Speak, Waldo. Please. Come on, speak up. Yeah, you see? Nothing.
Oh, go f*** yourself.
Oh, it's more swearing.
You're a joke. You look less human than I do, and I'm a made-up bear.
Okay, that's a scene from the Black Mirror episode, the Waldo moment, where Waldo is the CGI bear who's running for parliament and is in a debate with a conservative politician running for parliament. So it seems to me that that's almost like a dystopian version of what comics like Sacha Baron Cohen as Ali G or Robert Smigel as Triumph, the Insult Comic Dog, have done, which is take their humor into the real world and confront politicians in persona. But the way you're doing it on the TV show, it leads to just really bad things all the way around. Whereas I think, you know, Ali G and Triumph are very funny.
Yes. And Ali G was very much on our minds when we did that episode. I used to work on the 11 o'clock show, which was a show.
Oh, with Sacha Baron Cohen?
Years ago, which I didn't actually work with him, but that's where Ali G was on the show. Mm. By the time I joined the show, he was already so popular and successful, I don't think I ever saw him in the office. But what I guess that story is about was really about, it was a what-if story. What if one of these kind of insult comics, effectively, a character, became a lightning rod for an anti-political mood that I felt was growing in the UK at the time, and then became sort of elevated to a position, became the mascot of sort of populist anger, and that's kind of what happens within the story.
What's it been like for you to watch a reality TV star, Donald Trump, become the Republican presidential candidate in the US?
It's felt inevitable. I mean, it felt inevitable. As soon as the first time I saw that he was running for, you know, as the potential Republican candidate, I just got a sense that he would win that, because similarly to what happened in that episode that you played the clip from, it feels like he's tapped into that same anti-political mood. It's fascinating and frightening in kind of equal measure. And I don't know where all of that is heading. I really can't work out what the end point of all of this is.
In an episode in the new season of Black Mirror, everybody walks around with a device like their phone, grading everybody they see. And everybody has a grade that they're given, which is the average of all the grades that they've been given by individuals that I've had contact with. I feel like we're already in that world, you know,
yes.
Or at least we're just like a short step away from it. Do you feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a million miles away from just how reality works. It's just been massively codified in that story, basically. It's a kind of sarcastic version of now. I mean, we are... Social media has made it and the internet and technology in general has sharpened all of those things. I guess they've always been there. That performative nature of life has always been there, that you sort of perform your personality, I guess, to everyone on some level. I remember my theory is that we've got that we used to have several personalities and now we're encouraged to have one online. So by which I mean, I remember once having a birthday party and people from different aspects of my life showed up, So there were work colleagues who showed up, and there were people I'd known since, like, college who showed up, and there were people I'd only just met who showed up. And I behaved differently with all of these people in the real world. But once they were all together in one space, and they were all mingled in one group, if I walked over to them, I suddenly didn't know how to speak. Do you know what I mean? Because, like, with some of them, I'd try to be all intellectual and erudite, and with others, I'd just swear and curse and be an idiot. And suddenly, when they're all in one space, I don't know who I am. And I kind of feel like the one sort of thing is that online, you're encouraged to perform one personality for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's one of those things that's feeding into the kind of polarization that seems to be going on, is that you're, I think that lends itself to groupthink in some way, or some kind of lack of authenticity. I wonder if we're better equipped to deal with having slightly different personas,
different sides of your authentic self.
Exactly, that you
that are brought out
that
by
come out when you interact with different types of people.
Exactly, exactly.
And the problem in a way is that online, that's sort of stripped away from you in many ways.
A little
you
too
know?
Subtle.
Yeah, it's sort of so I wonder if that feeds into the slightly inauthentic feel of the online world still.
But Charlie Brooker, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Charlie Brooker is the creator and primary writer of the British anthology series Black Mirror. Season 3 is streaming on Netflix. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.